Welcome to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast, the third in our series keeping you informed about the impacts of COVID-19. Listen to KPMG specialists in valuation and financial reporting discuss the impact of the economic slowdown on non-financial assets.
Welcome to this episode of KPMG's Financial Reporting Podcast, focusing on the impact of COVID-19 on non-financial assets, including valuation and impairment. The coronavirus has brought economic activity in many sectors to a standstill, and companies, workers, and governments are scrambling to respond to this unprecedented crisis. I'm Brian Fields, a partner at KPMG, and in this podcast, we've gathered some of our specialists to talk about the impact of this decline in economic activity on accounting for goodwill and long-lived assets, such as property, plant, and equipment. With me today are three of our top professionals from KPMG: Frederick Bort, Nick Bergemeier, and Julie Santoro. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll talk about key questions we've received about accounting for non-financial assets during these uncertain times. We plan to bring you a future podcast focusing on financial assets. Oh, and we're recording from our individual homes as we continue to work from lockdown. If you hear someone singing Disney tunes in the background, it's probably my 2-year-old daughter. Nick, let's get this kicked off. What kinds of non-financial assets might need a fresh look in light of current economic conditions? How should companies approach accounting and disclosure in this area?
Yeah, Brian, these really are unprecedented times, and every day we're hearing about new challenges that our clients are facing. That's because COVID-19 has, among other things, it's disrupted supply chains. It's created workforce restrictions, travel restrictions, reduced consumer spending, and all of this is being reflected in a decline in stock prices. Now, while these events create a lot of unique accounting and reporting considerations, companies are really going to have to pay close attention to their goodwill and then their long-lived assets, such as property, plant, and equipment, or intangible assets. And in particular, that's because COVID-19 has really raised the risk that these assets could be impaired. Now, when it comes to the approach that a company should take, you use the phrase fresh look, and I think that's really appropriate. And that's because companies may be required to perform more impairment testing than they're used to. Otherwise, they just might need to change their approach so that these new risks are incorporated into their analysis of goodwill and long-lived assets. Now, a quick example of what I mean by that. So goodwill is required to be tested for impairment annually, but could also be tested in between that annual test if a triggering event occurs. In more normal times, companies may not have a trigger, and it really isn't that difficult to reach that conclusion. However, many of the issues that companies are currently wrestling with are actually examples of triggering events listed in the standard. A couple of these include a sustained decline in stock price, declining cash flows. It might change to an outlook for your planned revenues to decline. Just other negative trends in the market or business environment is another example of a triggering event. Now, one final point here on this fresh look. There's really no bright line or one-size-fits-all answer to analyzing goodwill and long-lived assets. And that's especially true when trying to determine if there's been a triggering event, because it's really going to be based on the particular set of facts and circumstances. However, in most cases, we don't think it'll be enough to simply conclude there's no impact on goodwill or long-lived assets because the current environment is just temporary.
Got it. I imagine companies are trying to mitigate their exposures by taking decisive action while also preserving their options in an environment of uncertainty. How do company actions and plans impact the analysis?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be really important because of that for the accounting and finance function to really be in lockstep with the rest of the business, because the plans and actions really need to be front and center in the analysis of goodwill and long-lived assets. For example, a company may decide to idle a facility. Maybe the demand for their product is temporarily declined and need to set aside their manufacturing operations for a while. Government restrictions may lead a retail store to shut down a location. Other entities may need cash, so they explore selling an asset. Any of those items I just listed could potentially be a triggering event to test long-lived assets for impairment, and potentially even goodwill. But it really goes beyond just talking about triggering events. I mean, there are broader accounting and reporting considerations, but what really needs to happen is we need to take these revised plans and actions and make sure they are reflected in our go-forward information, that meaning our projected financial information, our cash flow models. And in many cases, those will be the primary tool used in the impairment test for both goodwill and long-lived assets.
Thanks, Nick. Julie, it's clear cash flow expectations are changing in many cases, but the crystal ball is cloudy, especially for longer-term forecasts. What are the big-picture considerations in evaluating whether an asset is recoverable?
So it's all about making sure that you have a sound approach right now to making estimates and projecting future cash flows. At the best of times, there is a lot of risk involved in impairment testing. There are many, many pieces of data. It's very complex estimates that you're looking at. And particularly in this now changing risk landscape that we're facing, and in particular because of all the remote working, all of this becomes even harder to do and even more of a challenge for your finance team. So the other thing to bear in mind is, of course, with the previous strong economy, many CFOs and controllers wouldn't really have looked at this for quite some time. So you may be looking at a situation where you need new controls. You may need to augment existing controls. And above all, with this remote working, how are you going to monitor all of this? So let's kind of look at an example. And let's assume that you're getting third-party assistance with your valuation work that you're doing. Remember one big thing, you are not outsourcing responsibility. So you're getting assistance, but you're still making the decisions. So some of the questions that you want to ask yourselves are, have you put together a cross-functional team that keeps the information flowing? Are you capturing relevant data that you need? And how are you validating that information? So the cross-functions can be myriad within an organization. Production, operations, marketing, finance, treasury. How is everybody working together? And who is responsible for actually looking at these assumptions when there's so many pieces of data? If it's many people doing that, how is everything being collated? And who's making those assessments overall? In addition to doing all of this, big question is, make sure you have your documentation. You cannot forego that as a critical piece of evidence as everything kind of comes together. So I guess at the end of the day, my bottom line message here from a big picture point of view is that it's highly likely you'll be getting assistance in this area, but don't forget that you own the process, you own the methodology, you own the data, and very importantly, you own the assumptions as well.
Julie, let me jump in with a question regarding methodology that we get a lot. We are being asked, can I use best estimates set of projected financial information, or do I have to create multiple scenarios? While you can use a best estimate set of projected financial information, it might actually be easier in these challenging times to use multiple scenarios. And here's the reason why. With scenarios, you can play out individual risk factors. A good example might be, we hear a lot about U, V, or L-shaped recoveries. If you plan out multiple scenarios, there is no need to hang your hat on a single outcome. You can budget for all of them. The other uncertainty is the length and the impact of the lockdown. When you plan multiple scenarios, it will make it easier to take into account how the lockdown might affect your company's revenues and any potential cost containment steps you might need to take. And yes, the difficulty will be assigning probabilities or weightings to the individual scenarios. This requires a lot of judgment. It will be important to have well-reasoned arguments and good documentation to have a solid basis for your selected weightings. Also, scenarios make it easier to react to changes. Instead of having to redo the whole business planning exercise, you can vary your probabilities. If you already modeled out lockdowns from 1 month to 3 months and it becomes more clear that you were too optimistic or too pessimistic in your assumptions, you can adjust your weightings accordingly. So, to close out, scenarios are not something you need to do. However, they are a valuable tool to take into account the uncertainty we are faced with.
That's a great way to break it down. I can see now how using scenarios may actually make it easier in some circumstances. But let's double-click on some typical assets. For instance, let's take goodwill. This is an area where a public company might be able to see an observable decline in its stock price. What does that mean for goodwill impairment testing?
Goodwill is often the biggest target when people are thinking about what impairment they need to do. For many companies, it's a really big asset on the balance sheet, and it's something where you don't really have anything specific or truly tangible underlying it. The value of the goodwill really depends on the value of the underlying operations. So the first point to make is, although intuitively we head for the goodwill first for looking at potential write-downs, we have to remember that under US GAAP, we have to go about this in a specific order. So we first have to look at the indefinite-lived intangibles, so things like brands that we aren't amortizing maybe. Then next, we have to look at our long-lived assets, so things like our property, plant, and equipment, customer relationships. And once we've tested all of those things, then we come back and we look at the goodwill. So let's just assume then, Nick talked about the triggers, that you've concluded you do need to test the goodwill for impairment. The critical test you're doing here is you're comparing the carrying amount of a reporting unit to its fair value. It is now, under change GAAP, it is one simple test, carrying amount versus the fair value. There was a change in GAAP, and it's possible some companies haven't adopted it. That makes the testing more complex, but the issues that we're discussing today are just the same. We're talking about projections, and we're talking about estimates. So when you're doing that, looking at the goodwill, a couple of the key questions that have come through to us are, so number first question is, well, you know, this is a really, really difficult estimate to do right now. Is it possible, as I come up to my next reporting deadline, can I just do an estimate, disclose that I've done the, you know, best estimate that I could and fix it up later? Answer to that is no. There is no provision for doing that under GAAP, so you have to do the testing in full before the reporting period ends. And the second question we're getting a lot of now is that there is an option in US GAAP to look at your goodwill and make a qualitative assessment and say, well, you know, in previous years, I've had a lot of headroom between the carrying amount and the value. Can I just really have a look at this in general and see if I think I still have that headroom and then move on? The answer to that also is pretty much no. You have to look at this very, very carefully, regardless of the amount of headroom you had before. And the last point just making under goodwill is, of course, not everybody is going to have to test in detail after having looked at all the triggers. But if you conclude that no test is necessary, you really got to make sure that all your documentation is in place to show exactly how you came to that conclusion.
Thanks, Julie. Frederick, we've talked about the difficulty of projecting cash flows. In evaluating the fair value of a reporting unit, what are some other areas that could be challenging in the current economic environment?
Well, Brian, there are three areas that we find challenging. These are the discount rate, valuation multiples, and control premiums. Whenever we talk about projected financial information, we also have to consider the discount rate, because the two go hand in hand. That means any risk factor that you take into account in your projected financial information, you should not take into account in a discount rate, and the other way around. Also, the current market dislocation has changed a couple of the inputs to the discount rate. First and foremost, the risk-free rate in the US is based on long-term US Treasury bonds. Those have reached historical low yields. However, there is no market indication that the overall equity risk premium has diminished. As a consequence, US valuation professionals have increased the market equity risk premiums to account for the low risk-free rate. The second item is the market approach. The market approach looks at observable metrics from publicly traded companies, most common are revenue, EBITDA, and EBIT, to derive a valuation multiple. That is then in turn applied to the same metric of the company being valued. These days, we see challenging mostly around forward-looking multiples. Most common companies have withdrawn their earnings guidance. Also, forward-looking multiples might be stale, meaning They might be based on forecasts or analyst reports that have not been updated for the impact of the crisis. So when you are relying on forward-looking multiples, you need to be extra careful to ensure that the underlying data has been updated to take into account the current economic situation. The last item is the control premium, also referred to as the market participant acquisition premium. This is the premium paid in an acquisition above the listed price of the shares of a company. In an economic downturn, we see these premiums increasing. A good example is the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, during which control premiums increased compared to the period before and after the crisis. We would expect to see something similar in the current environment.
Frederick, one other point I think on when you're talking about control premiums, and this is a question that I get, is the relationship between the overall fair value that you determine for your testing and then actually looking at your market capitalization. And there has to be a reconciliation between the two things. So we're not talking about down to the dollar, but it's really necessary to understand the differences between the fair value you determine and the market cap. You cannot simply say it's all control premium. So there can be reasons for that, for example, synergies, but you need to look at it carefully. And of course, coming back to the same point again, you have to make sure that that analysis is documented.
So, Julie, I get it. We want to reconcile whatever we come up with internally to what we can see externally. But stock prices have bounced around quite a bit during the last quarter. Which stock price should be used?
That is a really good question, Brian. With markets as volatile as they currently are, a single day observable price might not be the best indication. We want to take an average over a reasonable period of time to smooth out the volatility. However, keep in mind it is the volatility we want to smooth out, not a general decline in the share price. So here's the question that everybody is asking. What is a reasonable period of time? Unfortunately, there is no one-size-fits-all answer. It will always depend on the facts and circumstances. In the current environment, we are probably talking days or weeks, not months. For March 31st valuation dates, I personally would be very skeptical if the period of averaging would extend all the way to the beginning of March. However, depending on the individual facts and circumstances, you might have reasons to do so. The key is to have good and solid documentation of your rationale. Lastly, we should keep in mind that the world is changing almost daily these days. So for valuation dates in April or later in the year, a reasonable period might be longer or shorter.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about a few other assets. Nick, I know the model for long-lived assets, such as property, plant, and equipment, is different from the model for goodwill. How should companies approach those assets?
Yeah, so let's level set a bit here. So with long-lived assets that are held and used, this would be your property, plant, equipment, your definite-lived intangibles. So those assets are being depreciated or amortized over their useful life. And they're tested for impairment only when a triggering event occurs. Now, in light of these new risks, what we think companies should do is, you know, really take an inventory of their assets or asset groups, and the asset groups is the unit of account for impairment testing, and make sure that they're considering the plans for these assets. How have those plans changed compared to maybe pre-COVID-19? Also, they need to think about what was the financial performance of these assets. What kind of cash flows were they generating before? And what kind of cash flows could they be expected to generate in the current environment or in the future based on the company's plans for those assets, including any potential changes in plans? For example, some companies, they've mothballed their manufacturing facilities. Other companies have needed to shut down stores or locations. But others have just simply shifted the use of their assets. We've heard a lot about manufacturing companies redeploying their assets to make different products to, for example, assist in fighting the pandemic. Right? Some are making masks and shields for the medical profession, and others are making ventilators, which is a product they didn't make before. So they've had to redeploy their manufacturing facilities and processes in order to do that. Now, after taking stock of these plans, there can be a bunch of incremental accounting requirements. For example, shifts or change in the environment could trigger an impairment test. could change the useful life that those assets are depreciated over, but it also could change the composition of the asset groupings if they're being used differently. Now, if you do happen to have a trigger, the held and used impairment model has two steps. First step, often referred to as the recoverability test, you compare the undiscounted cash flows to the carrying amount of the asset. So if you fail that because the carrying amount is in excess of those cash flows, then you go to step two, is where you measure the impairment. And if the impairment is the excess of the carrying amount over the fair value. So you're often going to use, you know, to come up with fair value for this type of asset, a discounted cash flow analysis, right? But that's going to be a little bit different than the cash flows you use in step one. And that's because you're now in fair value world, where you're looking at things from a market participant lens rather than entity specific. Now, Julie and Frederick talk a lot about how to update your cash flow models in this time of uncertainty, and those considerations are really relevant in both step one and step two here.
Thanks, Nick. What about leases? Many companies just adopted the new leasing standard and have a new type of long-lived asset on their books called a right-of-use asset. Are there any special considerations for those new types of assets?
I think with leases, the main thing to keep in mind is that the right-of-use assets, or ROU assets, follow the held and used impairment model, just like PP&E. This is new for people, as you mentioned. Previously, there was no asset if you had an operating lease, so it couldn't be impaired. Another new concept you may not be familiar with is determining the fair value of an ROU asset if you happen to get into step two. And that's because leases generally are not measured at fair value. Now, when coming up with fair value of that ROU asset, our objective is to determine what market participants would pay to lease that underlying asset. So you'll have to consider the highest and best use for that leased asset. And that could actually be different than how the company currently is using the asset. Another challenging question we often get is, who is the relevant market participant to consider in the analysis? And that's so important because it really drives the cash flows that are used in the test. And often the market participant would be another kind of tenant or renter versus a financial buyer that would be releasing the asset.
Okay, great. You know, I'd imagine that in some cases, companies are thinking about rationalizing both their leases and their other long-lived assets. Does the accounting change if a company decides to sell an asset versus abandon it? What else should folks be thinking about?
Yeah, so let's break down those two categories you mentioned, sales and abandonment. So let's start with the sale. We're just focused on impairment testing for assets held and used, but there's also a concept of held for sale. A disposal group, which would be all the assets that would be sold in a transaction, if it meets certain criteria, there are six of them, but there's really two that kind of stick out and are the most notable. One being management with the relevant authority commits to a plan to sell, and another is that it's probable that the sale will be completed in a year. Now, if you meet all six of these criteria, you would classify this disposal group as held for sale. That means you stop depreciating those assets, and then you measure that group at the lower of carrying amount or fair value less cost to sell. So you might potentially have an impairment there. Now, interestingly, if you decide to abandon an asset, completely different accounting than a plan to sell. For an abandonment, the asset's basically still considered held and used. Now, when you make that decision to abandon the asset, likely a triggering event, at a minimum, you're going to accelerate your depreciation or amortization to just reflect the remaining time that asset will be used. And once you hit the CCU state, that's when you're done with it. The only value you should have left on your books for the long-lived asset is the salvage value. And then I guess back to leases and ROU assets for one final point here, is that similar to PP&E, a company could also decide to abandon a lease. And that could trigger that same abandonment accounting I just mentioned. But that would only likely be in situations when the entity does not have the practical ability to sublease the asset.
Thanks, Nick. This is all really helpful, and I imagine companies will continue to react as the situation develops. But Julie, as we approach first quarter reporting, at least for public companies, what else should CFOs and controllers be thinking about?
I think the last point we have to mention, Brian, is the disclosures. And my advice on that is really to be guided by the overall objectives of what you're trying to do. So the two key questions are, what do investors need to know? And really, what information is material to investment decisions? If you actually have an impairment charge, there are specific disclosures in the standard, but it really goes beyond that, particularly if you're a public company looking at the MD&A and your critical accounting estimates. You've got disclosures about the methodology you have used for your impairment testing, the assumptions you made, the key assumptions, and sensitivity analysis around those assumptions. And really, what were the differences between the fair value and the market capitalization? Plus, the wider consequences. Is there a potential that you might actually, for example, breach a debt covenant at some stage in the future? So all of this is really giving people information about what's happening and giving them an early warning of potentially what could happen in the future. But I think the bottom line is there is a strong expectation that disclosures in this area are going to be, number one, transparent, and number two, very robust.
Thanks, Julie. These are tough times for people and companies. It's hard to look ahead and predict the next turn of the road. But a cornerstone of U.S. capital markets has always been transparency and timely reporting. With Q1 reporting coming up for many public companies, accurate accounting and disclosure for non-financial assets is going to be a key part of the picture. Key action items for non-financial assets include taking an inventory of assets impacted by the economic slowdown, connecting with the right people in the business to make sure the company's plans and projections are refreshed and up to date, developing good estimates to inform the accounting and valuation of impacted assets, and evaluating disclosures necessary for investors to understand the impact and how it was accounted for. I know lots of companies are taking stock and figuring out how to get their businesses ready for what comes next. Accountants will play an important role in telling that story. Thanks again to Nick, Frederick, and Julie for your remarks. Here at KPMG, our goal is keeping you informed on the latest developments that may impact your financial reporting during this unusual time. Stay safe and stay tuned for more.
Thanks for listening to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. For our hot topics on the financial impacts of COVID-19, including impairment and internal controls, and more news on responding with resilience and readiness, please go to our website, read.kpmg.us/coronavirus. Stay safe and stay tuned for more on this important topic.